My name is Ray Boisvert. I am the Provincial Security Advisor for the Province of Ontario.
Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name is Craig Forces, and I'm joined today by Stephanie Carvin and Ray Boisvert over the magic of the internet, which means, of course, our sound quality is a little bit AM, but I think you'll enjoy the insights of Mr. Boisvert in relation to his work as the provincial security officer.
Yeah, I think I'm the only one high above the Rideau River today. This is part of our distributed operation setup. But it's great because, it allows us to speak with Mr. Boisvert, who has really leading up a new and kind of innovative office in Ontario, which is focusing on provincial security, which is something we don't hear very much about. So, you know, we have the opportunity to hear about how the province of Ontario is thinking about some of the national security issues and how it effectively impacts their day-to-day operations and plans for the future.
And so without further ado, Ray Boisvert from the Office of the Provincial Security Advisor of Ontario.
Yeah, well, thank you for joining us today. I'd like to start off by just asking you, a lot of what we do here with the pod sites is just trying to get people to explain what they do and how they got here. So perhaps you can, you've had a great career in both federal and now provincial security. So can you basically explain that for our audience?
Well, I started off way back at a time that used to be called the Cold War. So I wanted to be an intelligence officer from a pretty young age, and I was very interested in the area of with the security service of the RCMP used to be involved in. And so this takes us back to a time prior to CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. And it takes us back to an age where it was in the heart of the Cold War, where the national security narrative was all written around counterintelligence and foreign interference operations. There was very little work done in counterterrorism, if at all. There have been a few incidents in Canada we can certainly come back to involving some signature assassinations that killed initially killed one Turkish diplomat in Ottawa, seriously wounded another. And so those were back in 1982 and 1983. And of course, we had the significant and extremely tragic Air India incident in 1985. And that, of course, came just on the heels of the creation of CSIS. But back to when I first started, this was a day where the RCMP had the principal mandate for conducting national security, and it was done through a separate division called the Security Service, very much modeled on the British MI5 or British Security Service approach. And I joined to be able to do that. I joined the RCMP in 1979, and you had to do that first. So I went through training in Regina. Did normal policing work. I was sent out to the West Coast. I was in the Lower Mainland. And after a little over a year, I ended up going to do some specialized work and ended up in drug section. And I immediately applied. You had to wait a couple of years before you could apply to security service. Did that. But at that same time, in the background, there was a very, very important Royal Commission of Inquiry called the McDonald Commission. And it was approximately, I guess, about a 4 to 5 year process in looking into what was described then as the wrongdoings of the RCMP Security Service in the 60s and 70s. And it led, of course, to a number of recommendations. In fact, there was 5 volumes of recommendations and notations. And that led to the recommendation to create a separate civilian intelligence agency called CSIS. And during that time, there was a moratorium on any transfer to Security Service. And 2 weeks before CSIS was created on July 16, 1984, I received a call from a staffing officer saying, we're going to do one last intake of people from criminal intelligence into national security intelligence, and that I would be moved right into CSIS at its creation on that very day of July 16th, 84. And that's basically how I started my career.
So how then did you go from, you worked your way up basically from being an intelligence officer through to being the Assistant Director for Intelligence, which is one of the senior executive roles at CSIS. And upon your retirement, you went into the private sector. And then can you explain how you ended up being the Provincial Security Advisor?
Yeah, for sure. I did a lot of journeyman intelligence officer work, ran cases and counterterrorism, counterintelligence, and then ended up working in different places, including overseas, and ended up running the counterterrorism program at CSIS. So I was thankfully in a really good situation to see the organization grow and see the mandate change. By the time I left CSIS in 2012, about 85% of the resources were doing counterterrorism work, which is a complete contrast to when I arrived, where back in 1984, about 85% of those resources were doing counterintelligence. So with that, I think when I left, I really wanted to look at taking that knowledge, because I felt quite often people from my profession basically died with the tradecraft. They went off to retirement, and I could see that shift in the threat environment was becoming far more evolved. It was fast moving. It was far more complex. And things like cybersecurity, this idea that people were remotely attacking our networks and not just stealing government secrets, but stealing trade and intellectual property secrets, was a big gap. And I was hoping to fill that in private practice. Did that for about almost 5 years. And I was asked to come in and build, again, reflective of this constant changing nature of the security environment, a security approach to national security that had a provincial perspective. And that's where I came in January of 2017 to build this new office, which is the only one of its kind in the country, and one wherein we're still building and evolving what that looks like and what that model most effectively should be.
So Ray, can you give us a better sense as to what the provincial office does? When we think of national security, we reach quickly for federal institutions, and Stephanie and I have over the last couple of months talked about many of those federal institutions, and we've had pod sites with people from them. But of course, the provinces have an important remit in our system of governance. And so what exactly do you see the space being from a security perspective at a provincial level for a provincial government agency?
Well, the reality is, and I take a very, very broad view of one defining security. And part of my perspective on this is that we now live in a converged security environment. There are no decisions that can be made, any kind of business decisions, any kind of institutional or enterprise-wide decisions that can be taken without a security perspective. Ontario is, of course, a significant economy in this country. It's not alone, though. All 13 sub-national jurisdictions, that's all the provinces and territories, are all effectively out there and engaging the world. Their citizens are traveling. Their representatives are trying to encourage foreign direct investment, inbound foreign direct investment, or FDI, to Canada. We are digital networks reach around the world. We have foreign fighters with Canadian passports. When you think of it, probably it's easy to argue that out of all those Canadians who have gone to conflict zones or are still there, most of them probably have or had an address somewhere in the Greater Toronto or Hamilton area, London and Ottawa and so on. So the point being is that our tagline unofficially is that all threats are global, but their effect is local. So it doesn't matter what kind of threat it is, a remote attack from cyber or somebody coming back with that kind of conflict zone experience and moving back home means that the impact will be local. If we take the foreign fighter example, that person will be accessing healthcare, schools, housing. They'll probably be potentially engaging with local police or law enforcement, any number of things. And that is the point. Up until now, however, because of need to know around and also issues of security clearances and practice itself in terms of having the kind of people who have the right kind of practitioner savvy, the provinces have always been left outside of that circle of knowledge and understanding. And that in this complex and high velocity threat environment, where again, threats are now increasingly globalized, but they still target local entities and local assets, we needed to develop a provincial capability to one, secure the environment, to help inform decision making, and also help to be able to share information and knowledge, and not just receiving from the federal security establishment, but also hopefully being a net contributor to understanding that threat environment. I can explain a bit more later as to what we mean, especially when you think about critical infrastructure, think about the number of assets, and also recognizing that, for example, a place like Ontario is a G17 economy. So if we were a nation state, we'd be somewhere between Turkey and Saudi Arabia. That matters to the world. And that means we're attracting lots of opportunities, but also a lot of threat actors.
Can I ask, so as listeners to this podcast will know, I participate in this Georgetown simulation involving national security, which involves not just Canadian, but US, British, and Australian agencies And this year we also had provincial agencies involved. And one of the things that came up in terms of the way the SIM run was that the provincial agencies and the federal agencies had difficulty communicating because the provincial agencies were not operating in a classified environment. Is that an issue for you? And if it is there a solution?
Absolutely. And it's been a fair impediment. I mean, it's been fairly described. And I've been on the other side. Having been the assistant director at CSIS and having had the intelligence piece, in other words, the knowledge sharing responsibility, and we had places like New Brunswick, the head of the security portfolio there was an early pioneer of the idea that local jurisdictions, subnational jurisdictions have a role to play and have a need for intelligence. The impediment has always been, well, one, do you have people with the right security clearances? So in other words, our personnel, have they been cleared to the national standard, to the government security policy standard of the federal government? Do you have facilities that can be certified to meet those standards? And do you have a methodology, do you have a practice that would ensure that there's minimization of sensitive information, that there's confidentiality assured, that there's a way to communicate, to inform without jeopardizing sources or methodologies? All those things have to be considered. So in Ontario, we just simply fast-forward the process. I am former CSIS. My director of operations is also the deputy provincial security advisor, is also a former senior CSIS manager with about 25 years of operational experience running operations, the same with our two managers. So we were able to quickly meet that criteria of practice. Second criteria was the security clearances. All of us have, as per my agreement with the Privy Council Office in Ottawa, to have sponsored security clearances up to the secret level for everybody and moving back again to TS or top secret for some of them, including myself. The other issue is the actual facility. Can you construct something? Will the province be willing to invest? And Ontario has. So we are currently in fact, building a new facility for our office, which will have the communications and data center that will meet, hopefully once we're done, certification to the top secret level. So with those three pieces in mind, or those three pieces in place, we should have a much better information sharing process between the province and the federal government. And as I said at the outset, it's not about just being a taker. We're not just here to receive information. We also want to contribute because we have access to insights. We have access to critical infrastructure owners. And we have probably, arguably, we are the biggest regulator of critical infrastructure in the country. So all these sort of things as just one subset of the many areas we're responsible for that can make a difference in securing Canadian interests broadly at home and overseas.
So given what you're saying here, do you see your new kind of provincial role as playing a collection role in Canadian security and intelligence, as well as kind of an analytical role and an advice role?
It is definitely the latter. We're an analytical shop. We do not collect information. We do not, in other words, investigate people. We do not investigate issues. So we have no mandate to do that. It is really about having information that is publicly available. It's also around using information we receive from that's been collected lawfully and collected for a consistent purpose, and that we try to get a big picture perspective. This is around strategic advice. We are not a tactical unit. So we don't respond to issues. So, for example, my mandate, as announced by the Secretary of Cabinet, who I report to, is the following. Ray and his team are coming into Ontario to help contribute to the prosperity agenda of the province. To number two, help us protect critical infrastructure. And thirdly, to help us be more resilient on the issue of cybersecurity. On the latter, as an example, I am not responsible for delivering cybersecurity. That's the role of our CISO, our Chief Information Security Officer. But our role is to look at strategic issues that can affect the security of our networks and to communicate that to those who have carriage or direct responsibility for executing those mandates.
Great. Then finally, just with regards to the office itself, can you describe what it looks like and how many staff you have? You've suggested you're an analytical shop. So, what does your office look like and how can you explain a typical day as it were?
What it is, we've grown. We're getting close to around well, I guess a dozen and a half people. We have a variety of skill sets. As I said earlier, we have a number of the management team represents a measurable level of experience, especially in the national security world. Otherwise, we've hired a number of young analysts, many of them pretty recent graduates from graduate schools in Ontario. And most of them have had very relevant sort of educational backgrounds around global affairs, multidisciplinary things, including international relations and so on. We've also leveraged that with a few people who had some other analytical experience, either as consultants in the private sector, building things like threat and risk assessments, business intelligence, and so on. We also have some cybersecurity expertise, but more at the policy level, again, not the practice level. We typically spend a lot of our focus around this idea that job one in a fast-moving, changing, or evolving threat environment is very simple, very simply put, situational awareness. Do you truly understand the threat environment? Do you truly understand the environment you're operating in to deliver your services, to deliver your programs and so on to citizens or to other persons within the government environment and to what we call the broader public sector? Those are all, for example, the independent agencies of government, everything from Ontario Power Generation to Metrolinx, the LCBO and the OLG and all those other acronyms that represent sort of things that Ontarians quite often interface with in their daily lives. And so we do some outreach there. We speak to some of those sectors. We try to make sure that they understand that from our perspective, what we think is threatening the province is prosperity, it's critical infrastructure, or it's cyber resilience. And we try to contextualize that in a way that people can understand it. So we take things that we see strategically. We go through a tremendous amount of open information in terms of news reports and other things. We try to situate, we try to look at those threats through a provincial lens and see where they fit. And then we try to convey that information around awareness pieces. And I do a number of public presentations. I think in the last year, I did 96 various public presentations and interventions where I went out there and spoke to audiences around what matters to them and why security is relevant in decision-making and what sort of things may threaten the province or threaten our interests. So those kind of things happen day in, day out. We do, typically in business and government, we meet others. And we also been called in as, in some ways, a bit of a consultancy. We quite often there'll be a strategic threat or strategic issue that perhaps some of our stakeholders, some ministries or agencies are looking for a different perspective or some advice on how to maintain security in government operations at a time where it's complicated out there.
Ray, so just on the issue of critical infrastructure, obviously a very topical issue at present, and not just in terms of cyber, but more generally. So much of the critical infrastructure is in the hands of the private sector, and to the extent that it's regulated provincially. And so the question I would have is, are we equipped legally and operationally to grapple with the provincial dominance in relation to a critical infrastructure? And I guess a follow-up would be, what are you looking for in terms of a national critical infrastructure plan and its interface with the provincial function and role?
Well, it's a constantly evolving policy area, there's no doubt. For all the reasons I mentioned at the outset, things are changing. They're changing fast. The threat environment, the capability sets that exist within the full spectrum of threat actors, from nation states to adventurous hackers to criminal organized groups. And we're also recognizing, I think we collectively, as those who work in national security, both at the federal level and provincially and territorially, is the idea that the conventional warfare and kinetic conflicts, violence, and so on will continue to exist, there's no doubt, sadly. But that increasingly we're moving to a fifth-dimensional battle space. We're moving to a place where disrupting democratic institutions, disrupting everything from elections to perhaps one day some of the service delivery that occurs. And some of those will be life-sustaining types of things from healthcare to power generation and energy and perhaps even the other sort of myriad of services that provincial and municipal governments convey to their citizens. So in that reality, we have to really consider this idea that, again, it's a full sort of scale of response. There's federal jurisdiction, federal responsibility for key things. There's a leadership role of federal government in the importance of their of the resources they can bring to bear. And also the idea we also need to be knitted together through a federal vision as to what critical infrastructure protection needs to look like. But that cannot be successful without also considering all of its component parts. And all those component parts mean, obviously, the provincial and territorial jurisdictional groups like us, or, for example, if I take energy, the Ministry of Energy in Ontario is responsible for Ontario Power Generation and any other number of other small and medium-sized producers and onto the grid and into the network and right plugged into people's homes. So there's that great responsibility at the provincial level to assure that, I think, arguably, all those fundamentals of our society get done mostly at the local level. So there has to be an increasing partnership. And I think we've crossed that proverbial Rubicon. I think the mindsets have changed in the last few years. Have we had a role to play in that? Yes, I think we have. Ontario said, we're a serious player. We're going to invest in this. We're going to build the platform. We're going to hire the right people. We're going to train them up in the same standards. And we're going to ensure that we can make a net contribution. So therefore, we need to have good exchanges of information to help protect those key elements of critical infrastructure. The next time there's a WannaCry virus or a NotPetya virus rampaging around the world, we understand that how that's going to look. We've seen it. We saw the National Health Service in UK be greatly adversely affected by something that was happening. This genesis occurred halfway around the globe, and certainly where national governments have to respond, but so did local authorities. So that kind of seamless integration, that kind of seamless communications and trust around how we all work together to keep the place resilient, but also to respond effectively when that next thing will happen, and sure thing, that will happen again.
So the current critical infrastructure plan expired last year in 2017, and I've heard rumblings that there might be a new one coming out very soon. I of course, have no knowledge of that, but if we do see one, is there anything that you would like to see in the next National Critical Infrastructure Strategy that you think would be helpful for Ontario?
Well, probably I would reflect back on my last comments on the question of, do we have the right policies construct? Do we have the right kind of relationships? And I think we generally do. I think we've done a great job now at of really amping up the dialogue. I just give ourselves as an example, and I think every province has perhaps a slightly different experience depending on how important they what kind of importance they place on that reality. In our case, we do. We have a very, very strong relationship with Public Safety Canada. In other words, we have ongoing dialogue, a number of files. We respect and recognize each other's core responsibilities. And I'm hoping that any new policy or legislation that would accompany that would just simply codify or somehow better illustrate in perhaps a bit more detail that new reality. None of these things can be done in isolation anymore. Nobody can expect to have primacy anymore. We all play different roles, and all those roles are important and that we must respect and stay within our lanes as much as we can, but there's a convergence of those lanes down that highway. And understanding those rules and understanding that, having increased dialogue and information sharing, I think we'll just simply, I think we're hoping that new policy, it will reflect that spirit and that vision that's now becoming pretty well common practice. There's still some road to go. I won't try to sugarcoat this. I mean, there's still some challenges once in a while. There's sometimes some perceived blockages where we can't share this, or maybe we can't share that, or not sure how we can do this, and the same for us. Plus, you have to know who do you speak to, especially in a big country. And then I'm really hoping if there was something that would really, I think, be important is a way to really emphasize the interconnectedness and the interdependencies that exist across the 14 jurisdictions, from the federal government to the 13 provinces and territories, and trying to find a way to either fund a communications network, try to certainly recognize, at least thematically, the importance of sharing information across all those jurisdictions. To me, this strategy will only be successful if any new strategy will only be successful if it reflects, again, that true nature of the environment, the current efforts being made locally, that is provincially and territorially, around being a reliable partner, and the fact that if we don't do this well together and seamlessly and stitch together as an integrated effort, we will have failures. And I think threat actors will leverage those and continue to target us because they'll see those weaknesses.
So speaking of trying to get to things before it gets too rough, one of the things that I find really interesting and fascinating and also problematic is, you know, you've talked about Canada, like Ontario rather, and that you have all of these kind of businesses and industry, and, you know, we're a G17 country basically. But a lot of these businesses are small, medium enterprises. They don't have the resources of a Bell Canada or one of the major banks to protect themselves. So how, you know, in your view, what can we be doing to better protect small, medium enterprises from some of the threats that your office deals with in terms of connecting with them and offering them advice on best practices?
Well, we certainly have not to this point. I don't foresee a time where we're going to have a very, very direct or extremely engaging relationship, because that's simply obviously not capable with a very small office of a little over a dozen people and doing what we do. But it is this idea, though, that we're only as strong as our componentry and our component parts. So everything is interconnected. Everything is interdependent in many ways. A small company of 20 people could also be doing some major work at a major government institution, or perhaps one of the critical infrastructure service providers, from energy to the financial sector, and so on. So I have a responsibility, I believe, to ensure that people are, one and foremost, aware of the threats, the nature of the threats. The reality is that insider threats, in other words, an individual who decides because they've been fired, or they've been maltreated, if they have any kind of grudge, they can pursue their anger or their discontent directly, even while they continue to work at the organization or after they leave, to the idea that people increasingly target from far, far afield. So I'll use as a quick example, the Ontario government network of 65,000 people, our cybersecurity folks deal with 40 billion, with a B, 40 billion security incidents on our firewall every month. So what that says to me is that the automation of the threats has greatly increased. These are bots. These are very automated approaches to cyber threats. That means they're affecting the small and medium-sized businesses the same way. And they're affecting, of course, the security of citizens, too. If there's been a variety of reports, but about 70% of Canadians say they've been affected by e-crime or some sort of malware at some point over the last year. That is a lot of people. So it behooves us to get out there, and job one is to make sure people understand that they too could fall victim to these types of threats, especially the ones that are pervaded through the digital realm, through cybersecurity or cyber threats. Having that alone, raising people's awareness, can go a long way in immunization. The second thing is about hygiene. It's about understanding those basic things around doing things right around your patching and your antiviral. And I guess there's probably, and this is one thing that has yet to been resolved, and except for perhaps a few places like the UK, is to set a certain baseline standard for companies, and those small, medium-sized companies. Should they be encouraged to at least hit a certain standard? And I suspect right now the preponderance of feelings that this should be voluntary. Happy, I don't disagree with that approach, obviously, but I would want to see something where you look at different jurisdictions around the world, look at Estonia, look at what they're doing with e-government, look what they've done with digital identity. One of the key things moving forward is that we're going to have to resolve the gaps in the trust factors, the trust network. And the only way to deal with that is to finally get our minds around digital identity. And to that in itself would be a really strong pillar to build a far more resilient society, far more resilient economy, and help those small, medium-sized businesses and individual citizens to be much more secure in this globalized threat cyber environment.
Ray, can I ask you a question, just circling back to your prior work on anti-terrorism? Of course, now the focus is on the issue of radicalization to violence. And as you know, there's been a fair amount of work, not just at the local level, but also now at the federal level with the new center. One of the challenges, of course, in the area of radicalization to violence is that if you apply, it can't be just an all of government model. It's got to be an all of different sorts of governments model, because so much of what might be involved in counter-radicalization involves provincial services, whether they are in the area of social services, health, or education. And so one of the complicating variables, it seems to be, in terms of crafting a strategy here, is to get all those different agencies from different levels of government to shake hands, all of whom are governed by different privacy rules that may not line up perfectly. In your experience, has this been a practical a problem? And if it is a problem, do you see a way forward?
I haven't experienced any serious flaws or any serious problems, only because it's being tackled at multiple levels at the same time, with generally a same shared sensitivity and appreciation around issues of radicalization. There's a long history to this as well, right? This is the same thing about any kind of gang behavior thing. It affects, it's equally in measuring practice, arguably, as if not more dangerous coming from the extreme right wing as it is from other sectors. The idea is that at the end of the day, we have to be sensitive to youth at risk. We have to be sensitive to individuals who can easily fall prey. Whether it's to human trafficking or it's to some sort of narrative that compels them towards hate and violence. These are all, it's not rocket science, so it's certainly, but it's complicated nevertheless. But there certainly is, there's been a lot of pen, there's lots of ink that's been put to work across a number of jurisdictions for the last 10, 15 years. So there's a body of academic work. There are a number of subject matter experts, and what I've seen so far is that they're working locally. We have in Ontario what we call situation tables, and it's a great way to quickly converge everything from social services and mental health to law enforcement and education, and a number of areas to help deal with perhaps the first signs of emerging vulnerability and trying to redress that or correct that, those sort of things. That's very local, very impactful. The policies at the national level, I think, really have to be perhaps remain much more strategic, understanding things and looking at some of the best practices going on in other jurisdictions and helping being part of that whole network of knowledge around radicalization. So what I see so far seems to work, because everybody in all areas, all three levels of government seem to be paying great attention to that. In other words, let's stop looking or treating simply symptoms. When I was responsible for the counterterrorism, the principal counterterrorism program at CSIS, as I used to tell some community leaders, that once it fell into my target zone, it was too late. This is about getting up that timeline and dealing with things before they become problematic and end poorly for everybody involved, including the individual who fell prey to either the gang violence or the radicalization towards hate and violence.
I guess my final question would be, is your office planning on issuing any reports, like public reports, an annual public report about your activities or about threat warnings or anything like that?
Not necessarily, not this time. I mean, I've looked at a couple of ideas. It's been 1 year and 4 months since the office has been stood up, and I literally sat here by myself for the first 30 days looking at the hiring and building of the practice. Many things have changed since then. We went from doing a lot of work around analytical assessments and raising awareness and tackling issues as diverse as data sovereignty to the issue of protecting public spaces. How do you deal with low-tech, high-impact attacks, as we've seen with vehicles in public spaces? So we did a lot of that work, now again doing much more, I would say, bespoke or more tailored consulting. So down the road, could we do more? Well, I'm certainly looking at, I've done a lot of outreach of late with the 444 municipalities in Ontario. They, to me, also fit into that perfect key core example of you're only as strong as your weakest link, and that you're also part of this integrated network. We're all connected together. And when you look at who matters most to people's everyday lives, well, it comes right down to that level of municipal and civic or civil activities that that cover everything from sanitation to policing and emergency medical services, all the way up to larger programs that deal with driver's licenses and medical care and so on, and hospital care. So all those things are part of integrated delivery of services. All of them are vulnerable. And so we try to touch all of them. The only stark exception, just to close off on your question, is that we've yet to consider going directly out to the public, because I think in some ways, perhaps at this point, a lot of stuff gets done locally anyhow. I'd rather be right now in the background providing advice to those who can better deliver that more direct bit of advice and knowledge to people on the ground.
Thanks very much, Ray, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for taking the time. And also, thank you very much for your interest in this. I think this is, as you can tell, I'm passionate about this idea that we're in a new era and we're dealing with new types of threats and we're dealing with them on a globalized level, and that our greatest strength really resides in the fact that we are all working together at all levels of government to keep our economy strong and our people secure and safe, and ensuring that Canada can do business with the world, and also ensure that we are the place that everybody wants to do business in.
That's an unusually happy ending for an Intrepid podcast.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.